It's that crazy choo-choo train. It's a soul train, he says, and it's a coal train. But it's a train that's taking your thoughts, your train of thoughts. How about that? The program is Lead Stories. I'm Patrice Lead, and the program is Your Views, Your Opinions. You can opine, you can critique, you can explain, you can hypothesize, but you've got to have a point to make. If not, the heavy axe will fall and who knows what. An appendage of yours would be on the floor. So, 888-874-4888, as we do on Lead Stories Open Forum. Really, the issue is that you present what you think are the most important things that are going on in your head right now and why you think. Hopefully, you know, it would be something not just esoteric, but something dealing with the issues that we've been considering from time to time. And I should thank you before we even get off to a further start, that thank you so much for your little notes of encouragement. I have had an issue with my jaw since being drilled by a dentist. I think he was with BP, or one of those. He must have worked for BP, because thank God, that was some serious drilling. It left my jaw in a pretty painful way. And so it was a kind of painful thing to continue to talk. So I'm okay, though. I'm getting out of all of that. So we good. 888-874-4888. Let's get on to what you're thinking, what stories are on your mind today. I just was amused by observing the news about the New York City race for mayor. Is, in fact, the guy who had no chance at all, had nothing but bravery and very little else to offer, in considering Anthony Weiner has apparently been at it again. So he's continuing to send sex tweets to people, basically about certain parts of his body. And that was the reason he got into trouble in the first place. But he's been at it again. And he comes out saying, listen, this time I really, 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 really mean it. I really need a second chance, another round of second chances for Anthony Weiner. But I don't think so. I think people have had it with that. And on the other side of that coin is Mr. Spitzer. I tell you, New York City politics is really entertaining just about now. Very much so. Very entertaining. You cannot make these things up. That in these times, with such very serious issues confronting people, You have a group of people so self-absorbed, so into the whole idea that the entire planet is there to serve them, and whatever they envision as their needs, and whatever they envision as their entitlement to those needs. And these guys, I mean, you have to wonder, after going through these horrific public embarrassments, it does take a certain kind of detachment, does it not, to believe that you can just come out and say, you know what, I know I've hurt people, which is Spitzerline. Yes, I've hurt a lot of people. I've made really huge mistakes in my life. But basically, the argument boils down to, I'm over it, so should you. You should get over it, too. I certainly am over it. I've done my time. I've been in the wilderness. And it's about time you get over it and support me, because it's all about me and all about my dreams, my hopes, my aspirations. Has nothing to do with what you're thinking. So all I need is your vote, and then you could get lost. But if I have to grovel, I'll do my 2 to 3 minutes of groveling, but I'm over it. Same thing, same attitude with Wiener as it is with Spitzer. Yes, we have sinned, but we're over it, and so should you. But then, you know, you watch these wives, these very, very modern women, who actually stand next to these creatures as they make these public pronouncements. They go, by God, lady, you ought to have some vestige of pride left. And you're going to be standing up there on a podium next to a guy who has very serious troubles. And you're going to be the good wife, the good, obedient, and, you know, supportive wife. I don't think so. 888-874-4888. Let's get to talking about things that you want to talk about from your perspective, from your neck of the woods. 888-874-4888. Thank you. You're on the air, Harvey, from Berkeley.
Hi, Jason. I hope you feel better.
Yeah, thank you. And I got away from the BP dentist, the driller.
Right. Well, I'm very sympathetic. And I'd like to talk about, actually, this leads to my comment is on health. And the question is, does capitalism and medicine, is that a match? Is that a good match, or is it not? And one reason I say that is because on the board of directors of large pharmaceutical corporations, say, you know, you had the problem and you can come up with the cure for $50, or you can come up with maintenance drugs for, you know, $100,000 a year. And the question is, if you're on the board of directors of a pharmaceutical company, your mandate is to maximize profits for the shareholders. Would you forego the cure of $50, the one-time profit? Or would you go on to the maintenance drugs? And I think that the maintenance drugs are gold mines for pharmaceutical companies, and I doubt whether they could see themselves giving anybody the cure if they can keep them on maintenance drugs for a lifetime, making millions of dollars from each patient over, say, the 20-year period of time that they can keep them alive. So I'm looking at that. I'm wondering if capitalism is working in our favor when it comes to maintenance, when it comes to medicine, and even though some people make a lot of profit money-wise, do the rest of us suffer because of it?
Okay, you put that out in the atmosphere. Let's see how people react to it. Thank you so much for getting things started today, Harvey.
Thank you, too.
Thank you. Thank you. Henry from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrecht.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
First time caller. I know you're a long BAI favorite of mine, but that's the ages, so I followed you up. My gripe this afternoon is about the Zimmerman trial. And I'll have to say that I really believe that with the we did the nice window dressing as far as the trial was concerned, because I don't think any judicial person with experience in the business of law and jury and trial had any doubt that there was going to be an acquittal. I don't think any really, really serious educated judicial person, whether judge or attorney, had any inkling that this was going to go any other way. And I say there's a couple of reasons why I say this. First reason is the type of jury that you select. That's the most important thing in any trial, is having a jury in your favor. It doesn't matter what the evidence is. As the Rodney King case and all the other cases of previous or past history showed us. So if you have a jury, and in this case, I'm quoting from Judge Mathis, the Monday after the trial, was giving a statistics on what percentage of people get acquitted when they have a certain type of jury. And he said that there was like a 66% chance of getting off when you have an all-white jury and an all-white defendant in case of a black victim. So take that as a premise. That's what the statistics says. Now, if that's true, then it holds that we already have a two-thirds chance of getting out before it even starts. And then you get a jury that more or less is in your favor, and all you need is one person on that jury. Doesn't matter how big or small that jury pool is. All you need is one person to say, I don't agree. Doesn't matter the composition. So if you got a two-thirds chance and you got one person in your, you know, in your pocket, and they do a very good job of filtering this thing out, everything else is a show.
Well, you know, Henry, the thing about this case is there was no case. It's not about the jury. It's not about any of that. It's the fact that the prosecutor went into this court without a case. And if there's any doubt about it, I suggest you go online and you download what this abysmal instrument, the charging instrument that this so-called special prosecutor concocted to suggest that was those it's an atrocious document.
Right.
So if the prosecutor can't figure out what the case is, you can't expect a jury to overextend itself.
Right.
When you go to trial, both sides have a version of a case, but you would notice that neither side referred to the charging instrument because there is nothing there to refer to.
I mean, to try for murder in the second degree or any type of murder doesn't support the evidence. Without it even going to court for the charge in the first place, as you rightfully say. But I'm just referring to an hypothetical, in this not so much an hypothetical case, but a real-life scenario in which we live each day and how the judicial system works. And we talked
The judicial system has never been fair. And I pointed that out because, we have to really come to grips with this reality that there is a dual system in just about everything.
Right.
And in the United States, it's very simple. You're either white or you're not. Those are the differences. You're either white or you're not.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're white, you're okay. If you're not, there's an in-between,
and sometimes it's called being famous, but...
You're either white or you're not. And they've been belaboring this point, but have we gotten over racism? Well, you're not working on it. You know, I don't see the white community working to undo the vestiges of racism and the badges of slavery.
Well, let me ask you a question. What would make a person give up their comfort? I mean, let's face it. We've earned, most people will say, I earned my way. But as life shows us, none of us earned our way. We've been helped by others. Everything in society, from civilization onwards, we've been helped by others. So nobody makes it on their own. There's no such thing. Leave a man in the desert by himself, he'll die. I mean, you know, whatever elements there is. Nobody makes it on their own. People need other people. So if you go to that stage and you look, you can simply say, well, you know, the vestiges of that system, the people are benefiting, and they're not going to give it up.
Well, this is the whole point, so that we go through these catharses from time to time when particularly heinous things happen, and the same expectation that Zimmerman had as a person entitled to exercise authority, because the expectation is the duty of Black folks or Latinos or Asians or whoever is not white, their duty is to make people psychologically comfortable about being white. So I don't get it. But thank you so much, Henry, for your call. Let's see how people react to what you offered today. Thank you. So, Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings, Yatrisa. Am I being
Hello.
Heard?
Thank you.
Well, Yatrisa, I hope you do feel a lot better, because I know what it's like to have work done on your mouth. I had to go back for a root canal retreat.
Oh,
and it was not,
Lord
it was
have
not,
mercy. I tell you, you go beyond pain. You just see stars. You don't feel anything. You just see the stars. That's it. So what is on your mind today, Sarah?
Yatrisa, I have two things I would like to touch on today.
Oh,
if I may.
Make with one big good one.
But yeah, I love them all together. First of all, this situation with the Zimmerman trial and the comparison with Marissa Alexander and what has happened to her. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to make in contrast with those two is that here it is. This was a battered woman who seeks to defend herself against an abusive spouse by firing off a warning shot and put him on notice that he needs to back off or else. Mm-hmm. She's been in prison doing a 20-year stint. She's already done 3 years. I don't hear any of these women organizations like NOW, the one with Dr. Ife Williams, the one, the Black version of NOW, the National Organization for Women. I don't hear any of these women getting on public airways talking about supporting this Black woman who was an abusive spouse, who is doing time, and they're not talking about it. But whenever
ever you had a stand your ground case, she was in her home, barged in, and she was literally at his mercy if she didn't do something pretty quickly.
To back him up, this woman had just given birth prematurely as a result of the abuse she suffered at his hands. She has a history where she has reported this man for spousal abuse. But mm-hmm. here it is, none of these women organizations, Black women, Latino, white, none of them have been on the airways touting it. They always like to talk about women's issue or women's solidarity. But when it comes to us, they're never out here to push our issue to the front. But when something goes wrong with them, like Latino immigration or the LGBTQ, here it is. They want Black people to get on, support their agenda, but they're never there to support us. So Black women, we need to really and truly look to see who our friends are and start checking them off, because
let's be real. How many Black women do you see?
Which is what I'm speaking of.
Many Black women are out there?
They're not out here, because I look at the Melissa Harris Perry show and a few other shows. They're always talking about, oh, we're all on women power and women this and women that. Y'all are pushing this woman. Y'all are not saying that this woman here was victimized. Y'all are busy talking about George Zimmerman, who got off, as you said, Yatrisa, in your soliloquy that you did outlining everything leading up to this case, which I'm going to go back to with the president and his lame duck speech, which I have to support Dr. West and Tavis Smiley on what they say with this lukewarm foolishness. Here it is that you're going to give this backhanded insult to Black folks talking about what happened to you 35 years ago when you're not talking about what is currently going on in this country to yourself as an African American in the White House and your family and the insult and racism that y'all have suffered. you're not even going to talk about currently about that. You're going to talk about 35 years ago, some lame excuse. And then when you finish doing all of that, you're going to come out with a big support for Ray Kelly, the New York commissioner, with a stop and frisk profiling in New York to put him up to head up Homeland Security, saying he's the best man for the job, he's qualified, and blah, blah, blah. Now, here it is that you people, like you said, you trees, we're not critical thinkers. We don't analyze information to go beneath the surface to see what is not being said. We go with the fluff. Oh, he finally addressed us. He has spoken to us. Eric Holder went to the Deltas convocation, and he spoke to the Deltas there. They went to the NAACP. They said all of these nice flowery speeches, said we are reactionaries. We emote. We look for symbolism without substance, and we go with it while we're getting insulted. Here, look what this man did in New York with all of these stop and frisk. But yet still, you're going to nominate him to head of Homeland Security, where this is a nationwide thing now, to him to implement what he has done in New York, perfected in New York, to go nationwide. And we already have problems at the airport with TSA and the unnecessary handling of passengers.
Okay. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing that the president should look to New York City's police commissioner to do that, because unless my mind is fading, I do recall that they have some explaining to do about the stop and frisks. And beyond that, you know, he would be the second person, second police commissioner that is sought for Homeland Security. The first one didn't do so well.
Yeah,
he did a stint in jail, as a matter of fact. you know, we had in the city of New York a police commissioner who was a high school dropout and was completely unqualified for the job, but none other than Mr. Law and Order himself, Rudolph Giuliani, thought he was the best guy possible. So, you know, so many years ago, at least 15 or maybe even more years than that, I had asked Ray Kelly about the surveillance issues because, you know, nobody discusses the budget that is allocated to police informants all across the country. Because, you know, it's an interesting thing where they say, well, this woman was plotting to kill her husband and they found out by informants. Well, there's a payroll for informants all across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't solve crimes in our communities, but they have a heavy payroll of informants. So second police commissioner of the city of New York on this Homeland Security tip. Thanks so much, Sarah, for talking with me today.
You're welcome, Andre.
Thank you. John from New York, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I just want to remark on the president's speech. Then I want to say something about Homeland Security. I think what was interesting is that the president did what the defense attorneys for the Trayvon case was unable to do, which put a gun in Trayvon's hands. You know, he's actually hypothesizing, what if Trayvon had a gun in his hands? So I thought that very interesting.
Yes, it was a very interesting sleight of hand, because that was his indirect way of saying to America, I'm being even-handed here. And another way to interpret it is that he was being very academic, because, you know, he used to teach a law course. So this was something that he probably would have raised in his class.
Yeah, well, I thought it was very interesting. It's also, he had this whole thing about walking while black, you know, as he's identifying with, you know, this whole thing, you know, where people are suspicious of people, you know, blacks who, you know, are just happen to be walking around. And it's sort of like, I don't know what the point he was trying to make. You know, it's almost like he's saying, it's okay to profile. And do you have any comment on that?
Well, I found it intriguing that the president, who is quite eloquent, seemed to have inordinate difficulty just stitching his words together. to talk about being black in America. It was quite riveting to me to watch him hem and haw and hesitate and you know, do all these parsing of words and these, like he's walking through a minefield. It suggests a great discomfort with his identity. And this is not news. This is something that has been tagged by him for a long time. He's just not comfortable talking about who he is. He's just not comfortable about that part of himself. Secondly, what I objected to mostly about the speech was that it appeared, because the media just ate it up, it appeared that he was finally, you know, getting emotional. The very unemotional Obama is getting very emotional and talking from his heart and whatnot. What he was doing, really, was iterating a really nasty message, and that was that on top of everything, to use this young man's death, A, to make a point about, well, we ought to do something. We ought to reach out to young teens and help them. And, you know, that is done by getting celebrities and actors and people with, I guess, philanthropists together to rescue young black men. The rescue that young black men really do need is a job. He should be absolutely, it should be appalling to anybody to listen to this president characterize Trayvon Martin in this way, suggesting, A, that, you know, he may have had some troubles because, you know, look at the statistics. He would probably have been a statistic in another fashion. In other words, whether it was Zimmerman who killed him or one of his peers, in other words, Trayvon Martin was almost destined to be a statistic. In fact, he said that he was going to be more likely to be killed by one of his peers. The idea that he put together a stereotypical view of this family, which is, to my mind, even though the parents are divorced, we saw them being utterly devoted to their child, very much concerned people. They don't seem to be like wild people to me. And in the same way that the president has a family and he thinks that he is a very good father, he's not the only one in America who thinks he's a good parent. It just got me so angry, literally. I think it just brought on my jaw pain again. It was just so insulting. And to make the point that he was coming around the bend to make a point about his economic program and about, you know, things are getting better. I know they look bleak, but they are getting better. You know, it was just, to me, the height of insult to use this young man's death, this tragic, tragic murder this way. I found it appalling, and I found it all the more appalling that universally, it seems to have hit home. Everybody kind of loved the speech.
Yeah. Okay. One final point that just came up in these calls. Do you think there is a purpose for the Department of Homeland Security, or is it just more bureaucracy and redundancy?
Look, the function. Every country has a right to secure its borders. I think to argue against it is just to be naive. You have to pay attention, especially in these times when people have really crazy plans. Really, really crazy plans. You know, you may be minding your business and there's somebody staying up all night trying to figure out how to do you in. So we do need to have the capacity to secure borders. That to me is logical. But, you know, what is never really said about Homeland Security is how it has transformed. The initial task of what was then called the Immigration and Naturalization Service was just that. The Immigration and Naturalization Service was an agency conceived to help people become citizens, to promote good citizenship, and to encourage people to not wait so long to be naturalized, but to become fully integrated in American society. That was the original plan. Somehow, it grew to be quite militarized. And so an agency that was formed to assist in a process of citizenship now becomes a police or military operation. And we needed to pay attention to that shift. Now, it is clear that these days, you know, you face as a country some new challenges that just simply did not exist before, and certainly not at this intensity. But the militarization of Homeland Security is what should concern us. And with that, of course, all the things that go hand in glove with it, you know, the awesome power of these elite groups, the automatic infringement of civil rights and constitutional protections, these are the things that we should pay attention to. So the expectation at that point, when people said the INS is failing, the Immigration and Naturalization Service is failing in what it's doing, no, this was designed to help people become citizens. You wanted to, you know, shoot people at the border. That's a whole different ballgame, completely.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Jill, you're there, I hope. Are you there, Jill? Okay. Then Michael from New Jersey.
Trees.
Hello.
I commiserate with you about your tooth problems. I think tooth pain is one of the worst pains you could possibly have. I've been through it myself. You know, I wanted to bring up something. You know, before the last election, the second time that Obama was reelected, we had some friends that we enjoyed being with them very much, and they said, you know, we're having a meeting here for Obama, this and that. And, a bunch of people getting together, why don't you come over? And we said, well, we're not really political like that, but we enjoy seeing people. You know, I love my friends and everything. So we'll just come over because I like to be with people. So we went over there, and they had some eats and stuff. And before you know it, these people, you know, they're kind of getting organized. They got clipboards, and they put on this this thing on the TV of this, you know, this polished up film of Obama with the flag waving and everything and all the things he said.
It's the big sell. The big sell.
Yeah. And I see this whole thing as organizing, you know, and I was uncomfortable already because of the whole scene, you know, these people. What could we do to help Obama get reelected, you know, and he needs our help. And, you know, this is what the Republicans are saying. They put on this, you know, this glossy film about him, and they show him on the podium, and he's viewed, you know, giving all his stump speeches, you know, little pieces of the stump speeches. And it's all very impressive. And the two people that are organizing it are not my friends whose house it was in, but they have the clipboards. And turns out that one is a trial lawyer and the other one's an engineer. And the trial lawyer obviously has reasons for supporting the Democratic Party. And so the engineer was also on, you know, working because he was working on the roads and he was getting a stimulus that Obama pushed through. So they had, like, vested interests, and we peons around here, we were supposed to, you know, be the worker bees. We were supposed to go out there to Pennsylvania, and we were supposed to canvass, and, you know, we're going to do all this grunt work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the clipboard people, they were going to reap the benefits of it, you know.
The clipboard people.
And the whole thing kind of disgusted me, and I was completely turned off.
Well, actually, you were probably in the middle of a process that has so much money attached to it, and that's called canvassing. That monster machine that was created that brought Barack Obama from, you know, relative obscurity, I would say, in the U.S. Senate to this nationwide character well-known man, was built on the strength of people. Leona Helmsley used to call them the little people, mm-hmm. the little people who go out there like worker bees and do the work. And next thing you know, they spin off that operation because now they are in possession of the thing that really, really generates money, and that is information. They know where people live, how much money you make, how many people are in the household. This is lots and lots and lots of very, very viable information that could bring a handsome price. And that's when they set up this spin-off operation in Washington, D.C.
Ever since I was at that meeting, Utrice, my email is inundated with Obama stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I see now he's getting back into it with a new initiative, to push through his programs, and you know he's going to get the whole operation going under a new name with a new tax exempt status. And my email's going to be flooded again, you know.
Well, you were probably in the middle of the whole thing and you didn't know it at the time. You know, this is what happens. You know, as they say, hindsight is what? 2020. Thank you, Michael, for calling.
You're welcome.
I enjoyed talking with you. Bye. Sean from Yonkers. How is Yonkers today? Sean, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. How's everything going with you?
Good. Thank you.
You know, I heard your rant yesterday with regard to President Obama's speech.
Yes.
And I gotta tell you, I tried to let some friends of mine listen to it, and they just basically they couldn't stomach it because they're very staunch supporters. And I said, well, listen, is there anything that she picked out that's not true? I said, for instance, when you pointed to the fact that he mentioned that he would have more than likely been shot by a peer, I said, you know, why would he have to publicize or say that? I said, and you know, as you pointed out, in this case, he wasn't shot by a peer.
No.
He was shot by somebody else other than a peer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, they pretty much didn't, you know, like it that you were so hard on the president because they thought it was a great speech and that, you know, the president finally came out and spoke and blah, blah, blah.
He came out. How about that?
But I said, listen, why does this president feel so uncomfortable with his blackness? You know, I said, that's something you guys should all look at. Why is he so uncomfortable with it? If you're a black guy, you know, be who you are, and don't be afraid to state it.
I keep pointing to a very good point of reference for Barack Obama, came mm-hmm. right out of Chicago, mm-hmm. was Harold Washington. Harold Washington had no problem being a black man, a strong black man, and
right.
he had a range of people of all types who understood that he had integrity. So, you know, this business about hemming and hawing and he's there and he's hesitating, it just, just annoyed the heck out of me.
Yeah, well, right. But again, like I said, most people, most black folks, just looked at the speech and was like, you know, hey, it was great. And then he finally spoke. You know, and at first I kind of glossed over, but then when I listened to it again and then I heard you yesterday, I was like, okay, somebody else heard what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and when I tried to point that out, you know, again, they don't want to hear it because it's involving negativity against him. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny because people who, you know, staunchly support the president, they act as though he lives in a vacuum and anything that goes wrong is not his fault. It's somebody else's fault. But I said, let's replace him with a Republican or George Bush. Then it would have been that president's fault and that Republican president's fault. You know, I said, it just amazes me how people have cognitive dissonance when it comes to this president, but were so vehement when it came to the previous president. And, you know, I try to tell them, listen, you can't hold it, have it one way and not the other. I mean, he's a politician. You got to hold him accountable just like all politicians. If he's doing something you don't like, you got to call him on it. You know, this silence that we have in the black community when it comes to him is sickening.
Well, look at the fact, as I said,
it's making the dear leader of North Korea.
When you look at the fact that, again, I used to say it was my estimation that at least 80% of young black work-age teenagers in the city of New York or any other major city are unemployed.
Right.
I saw that program on PBS, and they said, I was conservative. They said, well over 95%.
Right.
Now, entire nations people just go mad at a statistic like that. They just get out in the street and they bring their broom handles and whatever else they've got.
Well, you know,
City Hall.
And that's correct, because if you look at what's going on in Europe, I mean, in many of those countries like Spain and Greece, they've got 24% to 40% unemployment and they're in the streets.
It's insane. And, that the United States is so calm. But again, the president indicated how you're supposed to deal with this. The first thing he said was that he wanted to congratulate the parents of Trayvon Martin for handling this with dignity.
Yeah, right.
The next time somebody says something that dumb to me, I'm going to have to react. I'm sorry. You got the dignity. No. People shouldn't be dignified about things like that, because they're just it's just incomprehensible that you would expect somebody to suffer that kind of hurt. Like, they don't have the same hurt as any other parent, as any other human being whose child would be just obliterated like that. That's crazy. And to pretend that there is, well, we have to see this in context. That's what he did. That was his whole point of the speech, to provide a context. And what's the context? The context is we have to see both sides of the coin. Really? Is that right? You got to see both sides of the coin. I don't get that, but that's where the president is going. Like all things, he's a middle-of-the-road guy, because he's not going to be going too far left and not too far right. He's going to just try to stay in the middle, or more like it, stay in the muddle than anything else. Thank you, Sean, for calling in today. I enjoyed talking with you. Well, let's take this little break and tell you what's going on at PRN.FM.
Like a train.
Well, this train is chugging along. I'm Eutrice Lead, and the program is Lead Stories, and I'm hoping that you have something that you'd like to share with us today. Maybe whatever it is, but have a point of view. It always makes it even more interesting that way. 888-874-4888. Yes, that president's speech that people were literally almost in tears. And really, when you listen very carefully, you see, you don't have to ask very many more questions because they're answered for you. And it is regrettable, I think, that the president still cannot feel comfortable. Just be president. Just be who you are. I mean, that's why you got elected. People kind of liked who you were. So just go ahead with that as your the way you normally go about your life. You don't have to feel so apologetic. And it showed, it showed so clearly. Here's the leader of the country hoping and praying that every single syllable that comes out of his mouth would meet with favor from the people he recognizes are in real authority. He doesn't want to offend anybody. He can always offend anybody black. That's no big problem. you could tell Mrs. Martin, or the former Mrs. Martin and Mr. Martin, that their son would have been dead anyway, statistically speaking. You could offend the community by talking about, me losing all these young boys to, very negative influences, he says, as if to suggest that that's what happened on that night, that Trayvon Martin was a person following negative influences. The man was just trying to get home. And I think to even begin to discuss these elemental, fundamental things in this way, to make it so complex and so complicated, it's not that complicated. This case was not a very complicated case, really. If you had a mind to put forward a really very genuine effort, this case would have been made. And I think, you know, this is what people want. The tendency is to think that everybody wanted a conviction. No, everybody wanted justice. And I think even if it didn't go their way, they would at least appreciate the fact that it was a very tough fight. And that's what people want. They want to get a sense that at least there is an expectation, but when you come to court, where else should you not enjoy fairness? But this was just an atrocious case, and it continues, of course, to consume people, but for the wrong reasons. I mean, the trial is nothing. The trial is not a big deal at all. What preceded the trial is really where we ought to look. I haven't changed my mind about that. I've seen this happen so many times. You know, you have a lot of money spent, and you really could total it up. You have to pay these prosecutors to show up in court in their nice Brooks Brothers suit and their nice pastel ties because they're in Florida. You know, you have to pay for experts. You have to pay for transcripts. You have to pay lots and lots of money. So either way, the trial is a money mill. The outcome of the trial, well, that's not too important. You know, it's not at all important. And we have to take a look at these things and see it for what it is. You know, when something like this happens, like when the president talks the way he talks, you have to disassemble it, and you see the message right there. You don't have to go much further. You can get the idea where this guy's head is, you know. Which is why he could go to Chicago and talk about an economic plan, but not for his community. they have no part in this. You know, the economy is for people who are working. And you know what causes poverty? Poor people. Poverty is caused by poor people. And he really hasn't put forward any creative ideas, even from his own hometown. He goes to Chicago and he's just like, well, you know, I'm visiting. Not like a son of the soil, you know, not like a good kid coming back home and getting that warm welcome because people are still very proud or even prouder than when they first voted for him. And that's regrettable because here's a young man who, if he really and truly understood what leadership looked like, what it ought to feel like, and how extraordinary it is that he is where he is to make an incredible and long-lasting difference, not just for Black people, but certainly for Black people, because they've been hurting longer than many, many other people, but also for everybody to get with the program. The program is the economy has to be fixed and people's attitudes about race have to be fixed because that is impacting the economy. There should be, right this minute, you know, people are now talking about should this Trayvon Martin's death trigger more discussions about race? Who wants to talk about race anymore? We're over that talk. We want some action. Show me what it is you plan to do. Let's see white people working very vigorously in their communities. I even talk about this on the left. A lot of leftists, they stand up and they talk, but they're not going back to their communities. They would go to far-flung places of the far corners of the earth to say, oh, we're rescuing these people. No, the people you need to rescue are the ones living in communities with well-manicured lawns and still harbor the most trenchantly racist attitudes. There isn't enough work like this going on in the white community at all. You know, and I say that quite openly. When, I mean, when in my prime. I'm only 22, no matter how old I look. The issue was to tackle the contradictions in the black community, to point them out. And a lot of people disagreed with me. They used to say, oh, my gosh, she was always criticizing somebody. But there are too many contradictions in our community, and you have to point them out. I was, in fact, our paper was the only black newspaper in the country that refused to endorse Jesse Jackson the second time. Because by then he had become a complete sellout. And you have to say these things. You have to say these things. And, you know, it's not a bad thing to do. But it's a realistic appraisal of where we are. So I don't see very much work going on in the white community about race. But I do see when you turned on the television immediately after the verdict, everybody white is conducting a conversation involving blacks as if they are the authority on what needs to happen. And it told a really interesting story. There isn't even racial equality in the newsrooms. There was no black person. In the middle of all of this happening, there was not one black person who could anchor a very frank discussion about race. They throw you this one and throw you that one. But this is the work. Whites are not doing this kind of work. And to expect blacks to, again, carry the load of psychological burdens is crazy. There's just too much of that going on right now. Well, we're almost at the end of our program today, and you can tell I'm feeling much, much better. To be honest with you, I had been given some pain-killing pills to take, and I'm sitting down, and I'm staring at the computer, and suddenly my eyelids are just closing down. I'm saying, oh, I can't keep my eyes open. But these are the things that happen when you start getting old. Your teeth start to hurt you. Your hair starts to hurt you. Your eyes start to go nuts. You start falling apart. But, you know, under protest, I still prevail. So I want to thank Harvey and Sarah and John and Jill and Henry and Michael and Sean. Great, great people. You know, I love talking this way. When people just say what's on their minds, and we get to a point where we get more and more pointed about our opinions and what's really bothering us. So I accept right now we're wading in, we're just getting our feet wet, it's okay. But before long, you will be hearing some serious debating going on in this program. I am just so pleased that you take the time to share your thoughts. I'm really grateful about that because it makes a statement about the value of the program to you and the value of PRN.FM. I really believe this is a very valuable outlet for people to connect with each other. You don't have to be like-minded at all. In fact, you can be completely far away from the madding crowd. The main thing is that independence of thought ought to be something that is treasured. So thank you so much for joining me today. And tomorrow a good program awaits us. So let's hope we connect again tomorrow. Bye-bye.